you must have been a pretty well-educated little girl by the time you entered Swarthmore.
Well, I knew that I, when I went there to decide what to be your major, you know, you have to decide. We did there anyway, and I thought, well, most of the girls were taking English and Latin and things like that. So I thought, I already know these things pretty well. I said, I don't think there's much use of my doing this because whether I studied or not, I will always read. So I said, now the one thing I don't know anything about and I never would read and I can't understand it or comprehend it or have any interest in it were all the things in the field of science. So I decided to make biology, which I knew nothing about, my major. I thought, this is the only way I'll ever learn about biology. And then I had chemistry and physics and higher mathematics and all these things that normally I wouldn't I would never know anything about. So I don't think I did too well in them because it was not very native to me, to my disposition. But anyway, these classes were almost all the young men students, because they were all studying to be engineers and take it very seriously.
Yeah, and doctors and so
forth.
No,
not doctors.
Not doctors.
I can't remember anything.
Pre-med?
If we ever had anything like pre-medical there. Mm. But in this biology course, we even had the section of human beings, you see. It was maybe a pre-med from that point of view.
My goodness.
That was my major. Most subject I'm still most ignorant of in the whole world. I can see when I talk to my doctor and she talks about these things about your heart.
Yeah.
And I think, what on earth are these things? Why don't I remember some of these things?
You vaguely remember the drawing of the heart with all the ventricles going in, and that's about all I ever get out of it, too. What did you intend to do anything with your biology training?
Well, I never thought then about doing anything. Mm.
You didn't foresee a career for yourself then?
Yes, I don't remember. But I did think by the time I got to graduating that I'd like to become a teacher.
Oh.
But wait. I got when I was the senior year, not by any effort on my part, but I was awarded by the college a fellowship or scholarship, if that's what you would call it, by the College Settlement Association of America. I don't know whether you ever heard of it.
The College what?
Settlement Association.
Oh, Settlement.
It was a time when the college settlements and all the settlements started by Miss Jane Addams were becoming rather common through the country. And so they had formed an association and they gave these scholarships or fellowships, I don't know exactly what they called them, to every year to certain colleges. One was Smith, one was Swarthmore, one was Vassar. I don't know whether any others, but these, I remember these colleges. One was Wellesley, and it was awarded by the college to the person that was most probably interested in that field of thought. And I had a professor, Brooks, Robert Brooks, who came, I think, the last year I was there. He became a quite famous professor at Swarthmore, and he started courses in political science and economics, which I'd never studied.
Hmm.
And immediately I seemed to have a great joy in them. And he evidently thought I was very good. So he had this fellowship given to me. I don't think you call it a fellowship, though, but this grant. Scholarship, you maybe were.
Yeah.
And that was to go into some settlement for 1 year and help. And this was to pay all your expenses, you see, or part of your expenses.
All right.
And I went up to College Settlement, New York. I could go to anyone I wanted to. And
where was that?
95 Rivington Street.
Oh, in the city?
Yes.
All right.
It was in the Jewish section, next door to the synagogue. We were in the Jewish and the Italian section. So I spent that year there, and at the same time I went to the School of Philanthropy. I graduated in 1905 from Swarthmore, And then I graduated the School of Philanthropy in New York in 1906. And that's now called the School of Social Work under Columbia.
Oh.
It's been incorporated in Columbia.
Oh, I see.
I'm an alumna member of the year. I get their bulletins. I think I got one today asking for money and so on, or giving reports of what they're doing in the School of Social Work. So while I never went to it, I went to it under its previous name.
What sort of training did they give then?
I guess they give the same as they do now. They just had lectures, or authorities in one field after another field of what you call social work. Mm-hmm. And then they took you, of course, to visit all kinds of institutions. I remember the head of Bedford Reformatory, Bedford Reformatory for Women, coming in and lecturing us. And Miss Lillian, what is her name? People from the nurses' settlement, Lillian Wald was the head of it, WALD, but I don't think she lectured.
So.
Anyway, it was Mr. Edward Devine, Dr. Edward Devine, was the president of it when I was there. It was an extremely good school and had a very good reputation. And most of the people who went, they wanted to become professional social workers, and that's what they were being trained for, you see.
And is that what you had decided on at this time?
No, I had never decided to be by the time I'd been there a little while, I knew I didn't want to be a social worker or whatever else I was.
Yeah.
Are you taking this down now?
Yeah, I am.
I have to be more careful what I say.
Yeah. Well, Alice, I'll type it up for you and send it back to you, all of the whole thing, so you can look at it.
I'll tell you what I really felt.
Yeah.
I could cut it out then.
Sure.
But I knew in a very short time I was never going to be a social worker. Because I could see that social workers were not doing much good in the world. That's what I thought. Anyway, mm-hmm. I still think so. Mm-hmm. So to spend all your life doing something you thought, I knew you couldn't change the situation by social work.
Yeah. There wasn't any real reform taking place to prevent these situations from occurring.
No, I didn't think so. I thought the work we'd be asked to do. Now, the next summer, after I graduated, I was asked by, I suppose, somebody in the School of Social Work, but I'm not quite sure who asked me, to join the force of the Charity Organization Society. Did you ever hear of that?
No.
Charity Organization Society, COS they called it. And at that time, I think in every city in the United States, it was a COS. And it was called Charity Organization Society. And it's one of the lectures we had. I mean, it was probably somebody in the lecture course that asked me to come. Somebody did. And so I spent all that summer working for the Charity Organization Society, and we were paid the tiniest little sum of money, perhaps enough just to pay your lodging, hardly anything at all. And I worked in the office in my own section where I was living in the college settlement. I kept on living in the college settlement all summer, although my scholarship was up, and I had this little salary from the Charity Organization Society. And it was just a marvelous experience. I was an assistant to an exceedingly experienced social worker. And I was just sent to this family, and that family, the other family, see what their troubles were. See, then you couldn't get welfare, you couldn't get anything. The only thing anybody could get would be maybe to get a church to help her or help him, or to go to Charity Organization Society, which was organizing, it was to organize all the existing social welfare groups.
Oh.
They were all independent, you see.
I see.
Church groups and civic groups and any group that was organized to work to help people in distress was called, were all federated in this charity organization society.
I see.
So you'd get somebody, you'd be sent to somebody who was needing medical attention. Mm. Then you would try to call up the hospitals and so on that she might be eligible for, get her in and get her for. Mm-hmm. Just all day long. So you got to know the city. Mm-hmm. I got to know the city of New York in its places which were sort of the underground place, not underground, but the underlayer of people who mm-hmm. were up against it.
Mm-hmm.
So all that summer I stayed there. Then I decided I didn't know very much. I was thoroughly convinced that what I had, I'd learned enough to know that I didn't know anything about this field of political and economic fields, which if I'd known it existed in the beginning, I think I would have majored in all these because that just was what I really was interested in. So I went to the University of Pennsylvania and enrolled as a graduate student.
Okay. And that must have been the fall of 1906. Is that right?
Yes. Because I graduated school of social work in 1906 in the spring.
In the spring, yeah.
And I had a certificate from it and all the things you get, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I could have become a social worker, but I certainly am glad I never did that. Mm-hmm. So then, at the School of Economics, I took as my major sociology, and as my minors political science and economics. And I kept on with that, with those minors and majors until I finally took my doctorate degree, but I didn't start to take any degree, excepting a master's degree, which I got the following spring, which would have been 1907.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to write a thesis?
Yes.
What did you write it on?
And I wrote it on them. It was called Toward Equality. And it was on the subject of equality for women in Pennsylvania.
Ah. Was that the first time you had picked up this subject anywhere?
I was wondering whether... I'm not quite sure when I took my master's degree. I can look it up in one of the old Who's Who, because I suddenly began to get questionnaires from Who's Who, and I filled them out quite a number of years, and then I decided I didn't think much of this idea of Who's Who, so I stopped sending any replies in.
That's why I can't find you in any recent Who's Who's.
Well, I didn't send any more.
Yeah.
I just didn't see why people, it's anybody's business, all these things, questions they ask you.
Yeah.
Any conceivable reason for it. So I just didn't fill them out anymore. But I do have some old ones probably, and then I would remember what year I graduated in.
All right.
Took my master's degree.
Well, I can check that out. Let me just make a note here to myself. If I see an old Who's Who. Well,
asked me if I had written a thesis. I don't think I wrote a thesis. That first year is what made me suddenly pause.
Oh.
But of course I'm not, because I didn't remember very well about my thesis. Anyway, I don't know whether I graduated, whether I took a degree or not, but I took the courses anyway and passed all the examinations and everything and felt just great joy in it, especially this Professor Patton, I thought was one of the great teachers. Simon Patton never should made a profound impression on me.
What, was he in economics?
Economics, yes. At the end of the year, I was given a scholarship, I suppose you call them. I really don't know what they call these things, or a fellowship, to a place called Woodbrook in England.
Oh.
Now, this college settlement one that came to me, I didn't know about it even, and I didn't ask for it. I was just awarded it.
Hmm.
And It was more or less this one, I think, to Woodbrook. Because I don't know that I ever knew there was a place called Woodbrook in England. But Woodbrook was a central training school for young Quakers in the field of public service and theology. And young Quakers, very few of them, were selected in different countries to go there. And they gave you this quite liberal fellowship there. They paid all your expenses while you were living over there in the school. And it was a one-year fellowship or scholarship, whatever the thing was called. And so I received this just toward the end of my first year at the University of Pennsylvania. So I was very happy to go. And as the day, I think, of commencement, right immediately afterwards. No, at that time there were no women students at the University of Pennsylvania, except in the graduates. And there were very few graduate students.
Oh, I see. So you were kind of a rarity there.
Well, I was in the graduate school, and I didn't. You weren't conscious of it there because the few girls who were there were in those classes.
Yeah.
And we got to know each other very well, and it was a splendid group of young women whom I've kept in touch with nearly all my life.
That's one of the things I wanted to ask you, were the friendships that you formed at Swarthmore and at the University of Pennsylvania, who were the ones that meant the most to you, that you kept up with, I mean, later in your life? Like, I know Mabel Vernon was at Swarthmore. Were there any others who later on were involved?
Amelia Walker was. Her name was Amelia Himes when I knew her as a Swarthmore girl. She married Robert Walker. She was a Quaker, of course. And she was, my goodness, she was a senior when I was a freshman. And the loveliest person, I remember singing, being in the Shakespearean play, which by that time we were having these things at Swarthmore. And she was Ophelia. And was so, I still can remember her being so beautiful and such a lovely voice and singing so wonderful. So she joined when we went to Washington. She was one of the people who had married over in Baltimore, and she joined in our committee, was later became our national president, the national chairman of the Women's Party. I think those perhaps the two that I continue to know the most, just because they went into our own campaign.
And anyone at the University of Pennsylvania?
And the University of Pennsylvania. I just kept up with them more or less because that time I was so absorbed I couldn't take the time to really go to see or keep in touch with any more people, which I would like to have done, but I was always so awfully busy after that in the suffrage movement. I remember the one perhaps I knew the best was named Clara Louise Thompson from St. Louis, and I roomed with her for a time in the graduate school. You see, we had no graduate building or anything like that. And we had to live in little pensions around the university.
Yeah.
And she became a great Latin authority, field of Latin and Sanskrit, and went down to teach in college in Georgia. And I think she's been teaching there ever since. And I've occasionally crossed her path. But for about a few months, she came to Washington, helped us in our campaign, stayed there helping. First year I was in Washington.
I have two other little things to pick up at Swarthmore. One is Mabel told me that she met you when you and she were on a debating team. So I figured from that you must have done some debating in Swarthmore. Is that a correct assumption?
Well, I'm sure if I did, I was worst possible debater. I guess where they were teaching us how to debate probably.
Yeah.
But I remember Mabel being probably the most eloquent and best public speaker in Swarthmore.
Oh.
And when we were about, I graduated the year, she was a year older than I was, but for some reason or other, I don't know why, she was later in getting to Swarthmore, but she graduated the year after I did. And I remember we were in the Latin class together. It's the only class I can remember being in, studying the poems of Horace. I can remember very well. But she, I was made what they call the Ivy Poet at Swarthmore.
The Ivy Poet?
Poet, yes. And every year they had what they call the Ivy Stone that was put in. It's another stone put in by a class into the building.
Oh.
And they had an outdoor ceremony at commencement with all the alumni present and all the college present. And they had somebody who made this, a boy always, who made the speech about the presentation, presented the stone. And then they had always an Ivy Poet. So suddenly I was told I was the Ivy Poet, to my great horror and amazement. And I remember being all so troubled by that terrible assignment.
What did you have to do?
You had to write the poem.
Oh, write it, not just select one and say it. But
no, you had to write it. You had to compose, and the boy had to compose a proper speech connected with the placing of the stone, and the Ivy Poet had to sort of set the atmosphere. This was a great tragedy when this happened to me. And I once written a little sort of jingle, which was published in the college paper. And I guess that gave me the reputation of being a poet, far from being a poet. Mm-hmm. So I remember I struggled away and I wrote a little poem and took it to our English professor and asked him if it would pass as a poem, and he thought it was a very good little poem. Mm-hmm. So then I thought, well, I've done all I can in composing, and now the awful problem with my complete lack of all our rhetorical knowledge or any our rhetorical power, how will I ever deliver it outdoors to all these people? So then I went to Mabel Vernon. I remember, maybe she told me.
No, she didn't.
And I said, now will you train me so I can deliver my poem? So she undertook very religiously and to have me practice and practice and practice this poem. So when the day came, I think she got me up to a point where probably people could hear me. And this great audience, I gave my little Ivy Poet. I wish I could remember a word or two of it. I'd think about it, see if I could. Maybe I'll think about it.
Oh,
since it's in my first poem, I think. Mm-hmm. I think about it once in a while.
Had you written much poetry or been encouraged in that in your Quaker household?
No, I never thought of writing anything, anything of any type. Never heard of such an idea.
After you had this initiation into the world of being a poet, did you ever write any more?
No, never wrote any more. I'll see if I can think of it. But anyway, I remember my aunt, my father's sister, who was father of her whole mind, more or less, was devoted to the world of books and such. She, I remember telling my mother that she thought it was a very good poem, so I got some little support for it. But I said, I want to think it up, see if I can.
I hope you can. If you think of it and write it down. The other thing was, Mabel said you were in sports at Swarthmore. In sports?
Oh, yes, I was.
Did you follow on your tennis?
Or? Everything that happened, I took part in. Tried doing Swarthmore. And I naturally was, I don't think I was very good, but I think that I had the championship in tennis, but I'm not quite sure. Mm-hmm. I believe I did among the women. tennis players. And then I played basketball. Everybody had to play basketball, so I played. Mm-hmm. I played it with great happiness. I was very happy in playing it. And I played hockey. All the things that the girls played there.
Was there a lot of difference then between what girls played and what boys played? For instance, was baseball on the campus? And
I don't know. The boys may play baseball, but I don't remember ever hearing it. I remember they played football and lacrosse.
Yeah.
And the girls had an instructor in a very person we all liked very much in athletics. So it was just every afternoon. It was part of the regular routine, you see.
Oh, I see.
You had breakfast a certain hour, all the students together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at the long table at the head of the room sat the dean of the college, the woman dean, and she presided just as though it was her own private dining room. It was great decorum, and at each table was a certain number of girls, a certain number of boys, and one professor. Maybe there were not enough professors to go around, but generally it was a professor. And you all came in together, you all sat down together, they all had grace together. Then the boys arose and went out and brought in the food, and placed it on the table. And the professor was at the head of that little table. She just saw that everything was done with the greatest attention to proper form, because some of the people came from the homes, you know, where they hadn't perhaps known very much about how to serve food and mm-hmm. so on. So she was there to see that her table was perfect. Mm-hmm. And then the boys came in and sat down, and we all had the breakfast or lunch or dinner. 3 times a day we had this. Probably Mabel's told you all this. So
no, she hasn't told me any of it.
So then they cleared the boys cleared the table, took all of everything off, and came down and sat down. And then the dean arose, and with great ceremony, walked away from the table and out, and all the students arose in great ceremony, walked out behind her.
Oh, my.
It was a very dignified and very lovely regime that she, it was her own, of course, ideas and thought. And,
yeah.
And she's just a very distinguished family, Quaker family, and mm-hmm. a very distinguished person in herself. And she had an enormous influence, I think, on the whole sort of good breeding of this college.
What was her name?
Elizabeth Powell Bond.
Did she teach classes?
No, did nothing but be dean. Mm-hmm.
Did you personally get to know her?
Oh, of course. You know, there were only 400 students altogether.
Oh.
They weren't allowed, I think, I can't say exactly 400, but it was about 400. Mm-hmm. They weren't allowed to have any more. It had to be about 200 girls. Well, naturally, mm-hmm. she knew every girl.
Yeah.
She knew, made her business to know every girl personally. And I guess she made her business to know every boy personally. Then they had a director of athletics who was another big figure in the college, a man who was very much, I think, admired by all the boys, young boys there, and he had entire charge of all the athletic life of the college. She had entire charge of all the social life of the college.
What else did you have?
The president lived in the president's house with his wife, and he presided at important gatherings. I think he presided every morning in the college collection, what we called it.
Oh, that was a chapel service, wasn't it?
Yes, but it was also what they called collection. Every student had to go there. Mm-hmm. You had to attend this collection unless you were ill or something like that. And you were seated alphabetically. I guess by class, but anyway, alphabetically. Every person had his own seat always from the first year to the last that I was there at Swarthmore.
Mm. Mm.
So the president, I think, presided there. And then every Sunday we went to the Quaker meeting, which was on the grounds. And I think the president and the dean and everybody else, I guess all the professors always went there and stood up in the facing benches and all the students.
What other social life did you have besides...
Well, every night after the dinner, or supper, I presume we called it. I don't know what we called it. It was very simple. Everything was very simple. And then everybody was invited always, but they not a formal invitation, just from the beginning you were invited, to go into the social hour. You went or not as you wanted. Most of the students went. And this was held in the quite a large room on the main floor, presided over by the dean. And there was a piano, and some people would go to the piano and sit down and play, and some people would sing, and some people would sit down and talk to each other. And it was just a, of all the students, I guess almost everybody always went.
Mm-hmm.
It was a way to get to know each other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, did you have the temptations that your mother had before you of getting married at the end of your college year?
No, such temptation at all. No such thought in it. And I don't think many of the students did there then.
Oh.
Because she married somebody outside. My father wasn't at Swarthmore, you see.
Yeah. Oh, I see. But you mean students were getting married later then, later in life?
Well, they might have, but I don't never heard of any student being engaged at Swarthmore.
Oh. Hmm. That surprises me.
You see, they were quite young. As I was there at 16.
Yeah.
And I was out at 20.
Yeah.
Some of them were maybe out at 21, 22, but certainly nobody older than that.
Yeah, yeah.
Miss Amelia Walker, for instance, married Robert Walker, who was in her class at Swarthmore. You know, you didn't get to know the older people, older class people very well. I knew Amelia mainly by sight, seeing her in this Ophelia and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But she married some years later, but I don't think anybody at Swarthmore ever dreamed that they would get married.
Oh, I see.
It was sort of a generation. I think maybe people are marrying in colleges now much more than they were then. I never heard of a person being married or being engaged at Swarthmore.
Hmm. Yes, this kind of goes up and down in the generations, it seems like. In some generations, they marry in their mid-20s or late-20s, and others, they're for a while in the 50s. There was a lot of marriages that went on in their 19s and 20s, very young, and college marriages then.
She now, I don't know what's Swarthmore, but up here in Richfield, I have heard them over the television. I'm not sure it's reporting Ridgefield, maybe it's reporting all of Connecticut, or maybe it's reporting New York State, where they're considering at their boards of education what to do about the large portion of the senior class and junior class of girls who are pregnant. You see, you never heard of these things at Swarthmore.
Yeah.
And the boys had one dormitory, the girls another dormitory. The only time that you ever were thrown together would be in the meals, and that's only your own table. And it's one little social hour, which was probably an hour long.
Yeah.
And then...
But could you go out somewhere together after the social hour if you had a boy you liked?
Oh, no, you couldn't.
Oh.
You couldn't do anything. You went then to... Then everybody dispersed to their dormitory. The girls went to girls' dormitory, boys to boys' dormitory. You never saw or heard of anybody. Of course, I suppose you could have surreptitiously, but nobody ever seemed to do anything that was against the rules.
That's that Quaker conscience, I guess.
Well, it was just a rule of the college.
Yeah.
I never heard of. So I think people got to be good friends, just as Emil Walker got to be a good friend of Robert Walker. Yeah. They're sitting at the table with him all, maybe 4 years.
Yeah.
And then they probably continued to see themselves, see each other afterwards. And I remember when she was married, it was everybody was very much surprised. We had any idea she was thinking of being married.
Yeah.
I continue to know her a little bit. Yeah. Well, I don't remember anybody else at Swarthmore with me that married at Swarthmore. There must have been some others.
I wonder, in the friend's education of devoting yourself to a cause, would this have made a choice, like a number of girls now are making a choice like this, where they feel that they really don't want to devote themselves or tie themselves up with a marriage because they have more important and higher things to do. Was this a part of the feeling at all that you know of?
No, I don't think so.
It wasn't seen as one or the other? Was it mutually exclusive?
Oh, no, no. As far as I can recall, the general impression you had among the men students was that they were all preparing to sort of succeed their fathers in taking care of their families and so on, and having a family, and that they, and most of them that I can remember were specializing in engineering. And there was not any cause, it was just what they were preparing to do.
For the
and the girls were, I remember in my class there was a young man who came from the same school that I did in Morristown, the same friends meeting. And his father was president of some very large dairy firm in Philadelphia. And as a young boy, he had gone while he was still at college in the summer, he would go in early morning, 5 o'clock or something, under the direction of his father to help with this business.
Yeah.
And he was growing up wanting to succeed his father.
Mm-hmm.
And he did. But so he wasn't seeking any particular preparation in college, but most of them were. Mm-hmm. And then the girls, all the girls that planned to start in and support themselves, and you know, it wasn't very general, so general then for girls to support themselves.
Yeah.
If their families were able to, they didn't give it a thought. They just supposed they'd go home and live at home, and maybe they would marry, or they didn't think much about anything but finishing college, I guess. And but the girls who did think that they were going to begin to earn some money to help support their families were all, every one. I never heard of one who wasn't, as I heard of one only in the years I was there. All were going to be teachers.
Oh.
They hoped. And then last year they were taking courses of things they would teach, mm-hmm. and writing to different schools, say mainly friend schools, to ask if there would be any vacancy.
Mm-hmm.
And Mabel Vernon, for instance, was preparing to be a teacher, and she mm-hmm. became a teacher of German, I think.
Yes.
And her father was an editor, and I presume that she was really trying to help meet the expenses of all her own college work and so on. Then one girl, I remember, wanted to be a physician. And I think after her maybe 2 years, she left and went into Women's Medical College to prepare herself. But I don't remember anybody else ever going into a profession of any type.
Was there a lot of social work type of things gone into by the young women who did not have to support themselves?
No, nobody. Oh. Nobody went into it. Did anything at college. You see, I told you how this professor came, Professor Brooks, last year I was there, and started this interest in social. We never heard of it. Didn't know there was such a thing as social work.
Well, Alice, how did you get interested in the idea of political reform? Was it that year after college?
Well, you mean in suffrage, you mean?
Yeah. How did you come around to it? Was it through your work in England?
Well, you see, the year that I went to, first of all, I'd never heard of the idea of anybody being opposed to the idea. I just knew women didn't vote.
Yeah.
But I know my father believed in And my mother believed in and supported the suffrage movement. And I remember my mother taking me to suffrage meetings held in the home of a Quaker family lived not far from us. And I was just, I just never thought about there being any problem about it. It was some one thing that had to be done. That was all, I guess, I thought.
Yeah.
So then when I went to England, I went to this school of, this Quaker place in Woodbrook. I remember one night, one day when I was one of the students, wasn't it night, when I was a student there, I went into the University of Birmingham. As soon as I went there, because I wanted to go on with what I'd started at the University of Pennsylvania in the same field. So I enrolled in the courses, a few courses there, and maybe three times a week or something like that. And I rode in on the bicycle, I remember, through the deep fog. Main thing I can always remember is riding through this terrible fog in England on a bicycle into Birmingham, and going up the University of Birmingham. And there I went, I studied more or less the same field that I've been studying at the University of Pennsylvania, went on with it.
Oh, well, did you do that while you were going to Woodbrook?
Yes, I was living in Woodbrook.
I see.
And I was studying, taking the courses they had, and then they were very glad to have students go into the University of Pennsylvania in Birmingham and take special courses on any field that they wanted to. So I studied economics there, in that department, mainly economics. And then I went in, I don't know how many times a week, but to the settlement house, because I lived in a settlement in New York City, you see, I knew about them. So I went into it's called Summer Lane Settlement in Birmingham. And the head of that was a well-known, very prominent Quaker woman. And they welcomed me, and immediately, and every day I had lunch there with them, I remember. Every day that I went in, I don't know how many days a week. So then they said, because I just knew exactly how to do it, as it had been, I'd lived all the summer in New York City. So they would send me to this house and that house and the other house, but people were appealing there for help.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I got a very thorough idea of the poverty situation in a big city. And I know one night this head of the settlement came out to give a lecture at Woodbrook. They were always having people come and lecture on all subjects that they thought the students ought to know about. And it was absolutely a wonderful, wonderful place, this Woodbrook. Couldn't possibly say enough in admiration of it. And later on, my sister went there, and one of my first cousins went there. And gradually, from all over the world, young Quakers came. There'd be, say, maybe when I was there, there were, for instance, two from Holland, whom I got, and they still have been lifelong friends of mine.
Oh.
And there were from Ireland, I remember, of course, from England. And from Norway, and from India. Well, I've forgotten these places, but it was a small little settlement. You couldn't have very many people. They had one little house just for the women students, and so there weren't so very many. But the teachers were superb, I thought. And this one night, or one afternoon, I guess it was, there was a meeting at the University of Birmingham to which all students were invited to all these public meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Sir Oliver Lodge was then the head of, if you ever heard of him. He's a great scientist and a great name in English history. He was the president, I guess you'd call it, the head of the University of Birmingham. And under his auspices, they would have these distinguished or undistinguished people coming on all sorts of subjects. So one day they were having one on books for women. Mm-hmm. You didn't go unless you wanted to, to anyone, but I wanted very much to go to this one, so I went to this public meeting after your school hours, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Christabel Pankhurst. I don't know that I'd ever heard of her name before. Was the principal speaker, and she had a little group of two or three women with her. And she was Mrs. Pankhurst's daughter, you know who Christabel Pankhurst was, probably. And, of course, she ended her life in California.
No, I didn't know she ended her life in...
All the last years of her life she spent down there. I'm so sorry I didn't take it. So many regrets when you begin to tell me all these things, the things I think I ought to have done and should have done and wanted to do.
You but never did get
to have her in this country, and not... I did get up maybe two meetings for her, but then she was absolutely wonderful. Well,
where was
anyway,
she?
What did you say?
I was just wondering where she was in California, in Carmel?
She was in down near Santa Monica, somewhere down there.
Oh, I see.
And she died about a year ago, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, she was a very young girl and a young lawyer, one of the few women that would study law, I guess, in England at that time.
Hmm.
And quite entrancing and delightful person,
mm-hmm.
and really very beautiful, I thought. But so she started to speak, and the students started to yell and shout, and I don't believe anybody heard one single word that Christabel said. So she kept on anyway for a whole speech, and she was completely shouted down. So I just became, from that moment, very anxious to help in this movement. You know,
mm-hmm.
if you feel some group that is your own group is the underdog, you want to try to help. It's sort of natural, I guess, to everybody. So, from that time on, while I'd gone to these suffrage meetings in this country, there was no opposition at the meetings. Everybody was in accord. All the Quakers were in accord. This had been one of their principles since Quakerism was started, you know, equality of the sexes. Only group I've ever heard that had it in their first principles. First enunciated back in 1654. So there was never, it wasn't a subject for discussion. You just knew that there were many things in which the world hadn't come along, and this was one that had come along sometime. But here, when you saw this outbreak of hostility, well, I thought, that's one group now I want to throw in my arm, the strength I can give to help. And I went back to Woodbrook, and then I learned that Sir Oliver Lodge, who hadn't been at this meeting, was very aroused when he heard of this rowdyism in his college. You see, they had a totally different attitude than they have in this college here of giving way to all the rowdyism, which I think is a great mistake. Anyway, over there, Sir Oliver Lodge didn't have any patience with it. He wasn't going to say, well, we want to give the students all the right to express themselves and those all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. He said, this is a great disgrace to the University of Birmingham. I call a meeting, and all students, I guess they were all required to attend this meeting, which would be conducted under his supervision, and it was. He was there, and he was a great figure in American, in English life. Most distinguished, supposedly, most distinguished man, and Christabel Pankhurst and her friends were invited to present their case, with many apologies from him to them, as to the unforgivable spectacle that the college had witnessed. And well, no, I can tell you, no student would have dared to open his mouth at this meeting. So Christabel made, I thought, well, then I understood everything about what the English militants were trying to do. She and the girls, other women who spoke with her, they were all pretty young girls. They had anyway one heart and soul convert. I don't know how many others they had. That was myself. But the meeting was over, and very decorous indeed, and that was all there was to it. So then, when I finished at Woodbrook, my 1 year, which is what you all went for,
mm-hmm.
with that wood book, the one of the leaders of the charity organization movement in London came to speak and visit the wood book. Quakers came from everywhere, you see, if they were authorities, then they appealed. And it seems that this Quaker head of the settlement in Birmingham thought that I'd been doing quite good work, I guess, because she was invited to make a speech too, and people began to ask questions. And she said, well, I'm going to ask me, she reported me, she wanted me to answer the questions. And she said to this group, I think Miss Paul, I don't suppose they could be called remiss in those days, I think this young girl, Alice Paul, knows really more about all these points than I do. So I got to have quite a good feeling, as it seemed to me, toward my own little efforts and so forth. Yeah. So this lady who came down from London began to talk to me, and she said, I need an assistant in the charity organization work. I'm in charge of a certain district, the Dalston, Northeast District of London.
The what?
D-A-L-S-T-O-N. That's just the district of London up in the Northeast, in the very poor section. So she said, I want to invite you to come up and be my assistant, and we will pay a very tiny sum to you, which would maybe cover your expenses. And there's nobody there but one man who's assisting me, and you. So I said, I'd like very much to do it. So right then and there, we made that arrangement. Then I went over first to visit France for a little while and took my bicycle along with one of these Dutch girls whom I got to know exceedingly well. And we became friends for all our lives and there. And she married, ultimately, one of the boys of Woodbrook. Who happened to be a cousin of mine, a distant cousin. But anyway, we went together through the north of France. Normandy and...
This was that summer, I guess.
Yes, this summer.
What fun. And you just bicycled, huh?
Yes, I did, and she didn't. She went by train or something. And we'd always meet and then spend the night in some little pension, and then we'd go and see everything together.
Yeah.
And then I would go on my bicycle to the next place, and she would get there whatever way she wanted to use. And
Alice, what did you do when you had flats and things?
Had what?
Flats on your bike and things
I can't remember that detail.
You never had any problems.
I don't remember.
Wasn't that unusual for a girl to do a bicycle tour of France in that period? This was
I don't know. 19. If it was, I didn't know it was unusual. It seemed to me a very normal thing. You see, everybody in England always went everywhere on their bicycles, you know. You didn't think that you could go.
Yeah.
I remember many bicycle trips that we took there from Woodbrook with some of the boy students, girl students, maybe five or six, to this famous castle and this famous place in history and so on, all nearby England we went to that way. That's when I bought my bicycle over there, because I saw I couldn't go around and do much without a bicycle.
Yeah.
So then having gotten it, I just naturally took it over with me to France. And so then I think she had another term at Woodbrook. Because there were two terms, and I think I came at the beginning of one, and she came at the beginning of the next one.
Mm.
I think so. And I believe she went back to Woodbrook, and I went on to Paris. And I remember arriving in Paris on my bicycle, in that great city of Paris. And I had the address of the some student's house, conducted by English and American for students, with an enormous wall around the garden. I remember not knowing very much French, very, very little, although I'd studied all through Swarthmore, but still I didn't know much about speaking it.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I managed somehow, because a great many people spoke English, finally to find out where this house was. And I landed there and saw this great wall and went in. And everything was so lovely from then mm-hmm. on. And so I stayed in Paris quite a little while mm-hmm. at this very lovely student's place.
This was a place for our students.
Nothing else.
Plural. Yeah.
I suppose it was for American English students, but I'm not sure. It was a student's hostel anywhere, conducted by these English and American people who wanted to have, be sure their daughters and so on were in a safe place in Paris. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it certainly couldn't have been a lovely, lovely place.